Love is like the falling snow. Once it comes, it has to go. Never say so, it's a lie. Love's forever, 'tis time must fly. Yes, well, good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength, and today's programme is a celebration of love in all its variants, presented by DJ Hybridist, also known as Sandra Cross, who joins me in the studio today. Welcome, DJ.
Hello, William. Thank you for having me.
That's okay. And what was that piece of poetry you've asked me to read out? Or is it poetry?
Well, yes. I'm not quite sure. It's by R.D. Lang, and it's, you know, he did write, apart from being an incredible psychiatrist who had all these, at the time, newfangled ideas about, you know, how your family drove you mad.
Did your family drive you mad?
Well, I think it's safe to say that we all drive one another mad in some way or another.
Okay.
But so this is R.D. Lang called Do You Love Me? And it's described as, what's it described as? Knots, which was another book of his, which is poetry. That is poetry. This isn't exactly poetry. I think I saw somewhere, but I'm failing to find it now. This is almost described as a sort of series of little witty monologues.
And that was complete in itself.
Which
that
could
one.
Be read as poems. Yes,
it's a sort of slim
volume. That's one of the slighter pieces. There are sections where a piece might go on forever. One's
right.
called I Can't Hear You or I Can't Bear You. I Can't Hear You. And which starts, I Can't Hear You, You're Not Listening, I'm Trying, I Love You for Trying. And then it goes on.
Right.
So they're playful, very playful.
Yeah. And we started with Herbie Hancock. You've made a selection of various tracks and pieces. We're going to read out some poems, texts by people such as Anne Sexton and the R.D. Lang we've had. Herbie Hancock, anything to...
Well, it's just that I love that that particular phrase. It's sort of, I mean, it's a good way to start the programme, I thought, anyway.
Yeah.
But it's that moment when people look at one another and they sort of speculate about whether that is the person.
Ah.
You know, there's a momentary thing, isn't there? It can be a fleeting thing which can lead to something else.
Right.
I think this song goes on to suggest that actually he'd got it wrong. This wasn't the person at all.
Oh, really?
But I just love the buoyancy of that.
Yeah. And I've just brought up another... This is another track which will play intermittently or even repeatedly. Can you tell me... This is by...
Yeah, this is I'm in the Mood for Love by Mark Rabu, although you'd have trouble recognising it, maybe, because he sounds as if he's soaring on something, an instrument that we haven't necessarily been introduced to before.
Right.
He's a very interesting guitarist who plays with a variety of different people, you know, people like John Zorn and so on. This is not very characteristic, but I rather like the sort of...
It has a very melancholic sort of slightly...
Well, it's quite meditative in a way, isn't it?
Yes,
there's a lot of... there's a lot in there, isn't there?
Yeah.
It isn't being specified, almost.
So this is I'm in the Mood for Love.
Yeah, I'm in the Mood for Love.
It doesn't sound like he's in the mood for love. But anyway, so that might appear and reappear.
So basically when we talked about the programme, we were thinking of doing love letters, and then we sort of agreed that it was rather difficult to get hold of love letters, quite naturally, because they're supposed to remain private and they're secretive things. And the first people I want to sort of concentrate on in that way are Simone de Beauvoir's love letters to Claude Lanzmann. The thing I like about this... Well, like a lot of things about it, but is that she was a much older woman. She was 44 and he was 26 when they met, and they had a 7-year-long relationship. The love letters we can't see. You have to be a student and looking in the archives at Yale. And they only really came to light, I think, because Lanzmann sold 112 letters which were written to him from Simone de Beauvoir,
right?
Because he was in danger of they only came to light because he was in danger of being written out of de Beauvoir's history, as it were, by her stepdaughter or some, okay. some person that was related to her.
Right. Why? The, why was that? Why?
I don't really know why that was, but okay. I think it's enough to know that, you know, this was why he made this public. I think one of the letters was published in Le Monde, the online Le Monde, but the others remain sort of...
So we're going to read a piece from that later.
Yes, well...
We're
going to be reading from his book, his memoir, called Claude Lanzmann's book. I mean, for anybody that doesn't know, he was the filmmaker who made the incredible Shoah about the Holocaust. So, yes, where are we with this now? Yes, we're first of all going to have a bit of a lead-in by another political singer and activist called Abby Lincoln, who was married to Max Roach.
Yeah, right.
And these are political and intellectual partnerships and loving couples.
So you sort of divided the programme up into chapters in a way.
Well, a little,
We've got, this is older woman stroke younger man, political, intellectual lovers.
Yes.
So should we play the Abby Lincoln, then?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's play that.
It's cost me a lot, but there's one thing that I've got. It's my man. Cold and wet, tired, you bet. All of this I'll soon forget. With my man, he's not much on looks, he's no hero out of books, but I love him. Two or three girls has he that he likes as well as me. I don't know why I should. He isn't good. He isn't true. He beats me too. What can I do? My man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just a spare. But I don't care when he takes me in his arms. The world is bright. Difference if I say I'll go away when I know I'll be back on my knees someday. For whatever my forever.
That was Abby Lincoln, My Man.
Yes, rather troubling, isn't it, really? Yes. A different kind of love.
Okay.
Not very pleasant in places.
So you're going to lead in now to Simone de Beauvoir? And,
yes, well, they apparently Lanzmann and de Beauvoir first met in the early 50s, although I think I said she was 44 and he was 26. So de Beauvoir had published her seminal book, The Second Sex, which analysed the construction of womanhood throughout history and argued for women's liberation from passivity and social alienation. And at the time, Lanzmann was working as a secretary for Sartre, whose ongoing relationship with de Beauvoir was well known to be an open one, allowing both to pursue other dalliances. So there is one little snippet of one of these letters that Lanzmann sold to Yale.
Okay.
I don't like to keep on saying that they were sold. I mean, it seems a bit unfortunate. I don't,
if that's what he did, he did
I don't really think of him as being that kind of person. Anyway, maybe that was just part of the necessary deal.
Right. Well, it's a good home, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a very good home for both of them, really.
Yeah.
Apparently, these little snippets include the following, where she said, "She would throw herself into his arms and I will stay there forever. I am your wife forever." In de Beauvoir's letter from Amsterdam, published by Le Monde, she wrote, "My darling child, you are my first absolute love, the one that only happens once in life, or maybe never. I thought I would never say the words that now come naturally to me when I see you. I adore you, and I adore you with all my body and soul. You are my destiny, my eternity, my life." So that's all we've got.
Right. And now you want me to read this?
Yes, peace? Yes. This is from the book, the memoir by Lanzmann called The Patagonian Hair, in which he describes when he and de Beauvoir first sort of encountered one another. And the bits you've got there sort of refer, since I keep saying we don't have access to the love letters, this is the closest we can get to feeling that closeness.
Do people still write love letters, do you think? I mean, it's quite a curious phenomenon, given today's sort of texting and messaging and emailing and so on, all of which have records, of course. You keep a record of these things. But with a letter, you write it and send it.
Yes.
And very few people would have kept a copy of a letter they'd written. So once it had gone, wouldn't it? It would only belong to the recipient.
Well, ideally, yes, there's something a bit strange about keeping a copy.
Yes.
Yes, I suppose certain individuals, you know, might keep copies for posterity.
If it was typewritten with carbon or something.
Or if they knew that they were heading for some archives, you know, if they knew themselves to be famous.
But you would, if you were in the height of passion, that wouldn't, it's unlikely that would happen.
Ideally, I think it goes against the form, really.
Sure.
I don't think it's the form whereby you keep copies.
So I'm going to read this now. This is from chapter 10 of The Patagonian Hair. And Simone de Beauvoir. "We finally come to her from the first. I loved the veil of her voice, her blue eyes, the purity of her face, and more especially of her nostrils. Something in the way I looked at her, in my attentiveness when she spoke or interrupted Sartre, referring to him as vous autres, must have alerted her to my attraction for her. I sweated blood over the first article I wrote for Les Temps Modernes in my Chambre de Bonne on the Rue Alexandre Cabanel." So shall I leap now to the next
section? Yes, there's
section.
A very nice bit where he talks about asking her to go and see a film, and I thought that would appeal to you as a filmmaker.
Right, so we've missed a chunk. We sort of skipped on a chunk. Okay, so the morning after a party at the Rue de la Boucherie to celebrate the departure of Cao and Jacques Laurent Bost for Brazil, I found the courage, or the gall, to phone Simone de Beauvoir and invite her to the cinema that evening. I myself was leaving the following day for Marseille, where I would take a boat to Israel. "Which film?" she asked bluntly, clearly ill-disposed to wasting her time. "Any film," I said. My way of saying that it was not the point of my invitation. She understood. We did not see a film, but spent the whole evening in her room lined with red drapes on the top floor of 11 Rue de la Boucherie, gazing at Notre Dame. nocturnal and unreal. I don't remember now whether we ate. What happened afterwards has overshadowed all the rest. I took her in my arms, each of us as nervous and as frightened as the other. We lay wrapped together for a long time after we made love. She put her head on my chest and said, "Oh, your heart, how it beats," which overwhelmed me, suddenly, hurriedly, as though she absolutely owed me a truth I had never asked for. She said, "I must tell you, there have been 5 men in my life." And she gave me their names. Then she added, again, without my asking, that for a long time her relationship with Sartre had been neither romantic nor sexual. I was even more moved. This was not going to be a brief affair. She was establishing a different, infinitely more serious relationship between us. I was to be the 6th man. She had decided as much. Pride and anxiety fought within me. The following morning, she left to join Sartre in Italy at the wheel of an Arande, her first car, which she was driving for the first time. I went to catch the train to Marseille.
This letter in my hand, a plea, a petition, a kind of prayer. Hope it does as I have planned. Losing her again is more than I can bear. Kiss the cold white envelope, press my lips against her name. 200 words we live in hope. Sky hangs heavy with rain. Love letter, love letter. Go get her, go get her. Love letter, love letter. Go tell her. Go tell her. A wicked wind whips up the hill. Handful of hopeful words. I love her and I always will. Sky is ready to burn. Some I did not mean to say. Said some I did not mean to say. Said some I did not mean to say. It all came out the wrong way. Love letter, love letter. Go get her, go. Love letter, love letter. Go tell her, go tell her. Bring your kisses down upon me. Bring your kisses down in storm. And for all who come before me in your your slowly fading form. Going out of my mind. Will you leave me standing in the rain with a letter and a prayer?
So that was Nick Cave.
Yeah.
Love Letter.
Yep.
By Nick Cave. So we're going to go straight to Love Letter Written in a Burning Building.
Yes, but perhaps we should... I mean, obviously, the Nick Cave is just an ode to lost love and a terribly, terribly, terribly sad.
Hmm.
I mean, imagine if you were to get a love letter like that.
Yes.
This is a beautiful piece of poetry. In a song, contained in a song.
Right.
So that's that. So then the next
I'm sorry
one...
to break the mood.
Yeah.
But at some point, we need to do one of these resonance fundraising...
Okay, so I'll do one now then, since we...
Yeah, let's get one under our belt.
Okay, so here it is. This programme is coming to you live and for free. This month we're asking you, our listeners, to support Resonance by setting up a regular donation. That's the best way to help us make long-term plans to maintain and support our broadcasters. Please visit fundraiser.resonance.fm and set up a regular donation. Thank you.
Thank you. OK, so let's get back to St. Valentine's Day, the matter in hand.
Yes, OK, so this is a couple of things here which might be described as realism in love.
Mm-hmm.
And one, the first piece is a poem by poets I particularly like called Anne Sexton. So I think we're going to read it together, take it in turns with each verse.
Do you want to give a little brief background about Anne Sexton?
Well, she was often regarded... She's writing at the same time as Sylvia Plath.
Mm.
She's much more, for me anyway, much more kind of dynamic and visceral, really, very, very visceral. Mm. She, like Sylvia Plath, unfortunately died by her own hand. And her poetry was very confessional. It was,
okay.
You know, that dread word, really, confessional.
Sure.
So we've got Anne Sexton, and the title of the poem is called Love Letter Written in a Burning Building. I'm in a crate, the crate that was ours, full of white shirts and salad greens, the icebox knocking at our delectable knocks, and I wore movies in my eyes. And you wore eggs in your tunnel, and we played sheets, 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 all day, even in the bathtub, like lunatics. But today I set the bed afire, and smoke is filling the room. It is getting hot enough for the walls to melt, and the icebox a gluey white tooth.
I have on a mask in order to write my last words, and they are just for you. And I will place them in the icebox, saved for blank and tomatoes. And perhaps they will last. The dog will not. Her spots will fall off. The old letters will melt into a black bee. The nightgowns are already shredding into paper. The yellow, the red, the purple. The bed, well, the sheets have turned to gold. Hard, hard gold. And the mattress is being kissed into a stone.
As for me, my dearest Foxy, my poems to you may or may not reach the icebox and its hopeful eternity, for isn't yours enough? The one where you name my name right out in PR. If my toes weren't yielding to pitch, I'd tell you the whole story, not just the sheet story, but the belly button story, the pride eyelid story, the whiskey sour of the blank story, and shovel back our love where it belonged.
Despite my asbestos gloves, the cough is filling me with a black and a red powder seeps through my veins. Our little crate goes down so publicly and without meaning it, you see, meaning a solo act, a cremation of the love. But instead, we seem to be going down right in the middle of a Russian street, the flames making the sound of the horse being beaten and beaten. The whip is adoring its human triumph while the flies wait blow by blow, straight from United Fruit Inc.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's guest is DJ Hybridist, who's taking us through a trip of... where are we going with this?
Well, it's a kind of potpourri of various kinds of love, I suppose.
Right.
I don't know about you. I mean, that was Paul Buchanan in Blue Nile, singing Tinseltown in the Rain, which, again, which is a lovely piece of poetry, really. I don't know. How do you perceive it when he says, "Do I love you?" When he keeps on saying, "Do you think he's being somebody saying to him?" You know, do you really?
I don't know. Really, I suppose I got stuck on Tinseltown.
Yes.
In the rain.
Yes.
So I suppose Tinseltown is Hollywood.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Or something like it in the rain. So there's a contrast between it's sort of like glamour and. Sort of, well, rain isn't necessarily miserable, is it?
No. Although he does come from Glasgow, so I suppose, probably is quite a lot of rain in Glasgow.
Well, perhaps he's hankering after Glasgow whilst he's in Los Angeles or something.
Could be, yes.
The reality of it.
Yes.
But I don't know.
What kind of love do you think he's describing? Is it...
I wouldn't interpret it. I mean, I just get swept along with the mood of it. But we're heading towards chapter four now, part four.
Okay.
The world, environment, place, nature and animals.
Right, okay. So into this section we've got two pieces. The first piece is a reading from a book by a poet called Patrick McGuinness.
Mm-hmm.
The book's title is Other People's Countries, A Journey into Memory. And basically it's about his love for a particular part of Belgium, although he's half English. I think his mum and his maternal side of the family were from this Belgian border town of Bouillon.
Okay.
So the back cover of the book says, "Let me take you down the alleys that lead into its past, to a town peopled with eccentricities, full of charm, menace and wonder, to the days before television, to the sweet shop, to the Nazi occupation and unexpected collaborations, to a place where one neighbour murders another over the misfortune of pigs and potatoes, to the hotel where the French poets and lovers Verlaine and Rambo hold up while on the run from family creditors and the law."
Okay.
So it's described, you know, you get all this blurb on the back of these books, don't you?
Yeah.
This exquisite meditation on place, time and memory. So now I'm going to read a piece from it, which is called... It's broken up into small segments and coupled with photographs that he's taken, which are all quite emblematic. I'm just showing you one now, which is very...
Yeah.
They're always very...
Looks like a street lamp.
A street lamp, yes, but a particular kind of street lamp, which is once again redolent of the past and a particular...
It's quite sort of monochrome image.
Now there's a very amazing-looking telephone, which is stripped of all embellishments altogether, isn't it? Quite austere, but obviously full of meaning for him.
Right.
So this is called The Doors and Windows of Wallonia. Before television backlit them with its haunted blues, its gauze of voice over voice, dubbings of Dynasty in Dallas, there were firesides filtered through net curtains, shadows pulling free from shadows. The furniture didn't furnish, it loomed, heavy as cannon. It boomed, darkness. After close down, after the trembling, not quite stasis of the RTB test card, the blue glow lingered, fizzed against mosquito nets, caught the flypaper garlands with their incrustations of blue bottle. The banal... ship fly.
That's all right.
Apologies. With his coal face glitter. That was the house's pulse, a comatose cellar beat to which my grandmother Bouillon's only dressmaker peddled kilometres of stitching, threaded her needles 7 to 7 in daylight that took all day to dye. Her only books were swatches. She held them up to the daughters and widows of Wallonia, fresh with their ideas from Brussels of haute couture, their cutouts from Paris Match, a small-town catwalk of de Neuves along a corridor of Stockman mannequins stuck with pins, stained with oil or grease. And for me... Then for me, still so oddly sexual with their tapered waists, the perfection of their closedness. My face at the window, I'd watch her busy sparrow jerks inside the darkness that fleshed her out and smell the last but one all-day stew that held its own against the clashing scents of factory owners' wives. but the body that stayed caught in the full-length looking glass is mine. My drowning childhood pulling down, and these days nothing, least of all, my whole life flashes by. Only the empty mirror gives me back that time, and the lace curtains, more air than lace, are sieves for shadows to pass through light. Each time I breathe it in, that sublimate of all that's gone. Essence of indoors would be the perfume if they made it.
Dedicated to animals and the animal rights movement.
So we've still got Mark Rebo creaking away in the background here.
We should just say that that was Laura Nyro, live from the bottom line, singing Wild World, which is about love for animals, really.
Okay.
And the world.
Yeah. Section 5, Sons and Mothers.
Yes, yeah, so we move on to a couple of readings between you and me from a book called The Stammered Songline by Erwin Mortier, which is... it is basically a love from a son to a mother. And this is when his mother is starting to lose her mind, unfortunately.
Okay.
And you've got the first reading there.
Okay. Today my mother gave me a thorough dusting, thinking I was a piece of furniture. Perhaps a chest of drawers or an old cooker. She ran a bright yellow duster over my shirt buttons towards my neck, waved it about around my ears and dusted my chin. Then she motioned for me to open my mouth, stuffed the duster in and forgot us.
Okay, and so my piece is another memory from the same book of a time when his mother was in good health. And so it's obviously a memory that he loves to recall. I remember years ago sitting with Levin on the old railway embankment looking out over the marshes near the River Lys in the evening sun. We were sitting on the embankment in the tall grass. In front of us the soggy meadows, the rows of trees. Behind us the town and its hum. It must have been July. I remember that the hemlock had finished blooming. Levin said, "Look, there go your parents." They were walking on the far side of a wide canal at the foot of the dike, behind the reeds and the bulrushes, under the lancet-shaped leaves of the silver willows, he a little behind her, she looking around her with pleasure in the calm evening light. She was wearing a wide white dress that swayed in folds around her knees. They did not see us.
The sun comes up. I think about you. The coffee cup. I think about you. I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends. I think about you. I talk to friends and think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you love me. Or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind? I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me. Or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind?
Well, that is the remarkable voice of Mandy Patinkin.
There's no one like him. And we had to, and that's a Stephen Sondheim song, of course, which is one of his greatest songs. And Mandy is just one of the greatest exponents of Sondheim. And we've interrupted the section on sons and mothers to interrupt with this, basically this passion that, you know, has people literally losing their minds in the early stages of being in love, and just, you can feel his chest. I mean, he has this almost exploding. He cranks it up in the final section of the song, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He feels like he's breaking apart, literally.
Well, we saw him perform a solo show, didn't we, on St. Martin's Lane.
Yeah.
And he was just him, obviously, a solo show.
Yeah.
And he was doing it with such gusto that he was literally spraying the whole front row of the audience with sort of sweat and spit,
passion.
Basically.
He could sell passion. He could just sell it.
And, of course, he's re-emerging this Sunday in the new series of Homeland.
Oh, does it start again on
Sunday?
Yeah,
that's coming up again on Sunday.
Oh, well, look out for that.
Yeah.
OK, well, back to more sad things.
Right.
So these are a couple of readings from a book by Roland Barthes called The Mourning Diary, which he was devastated by the loss of his mother. I think he used to live with her. And every day, I think for about a year, he just wrote little scraps.
And that's mourning with a U in it.
Yes,
just
that's
to
right.
Be,
so yes.
Right.
OK. So if you'd like to read yours and then...
OK. Well, this is a short piece. To whom could I put this question with any hope of an answer? Does being able to live without someone you loved mean you loved her less than you thought?
Solitude equals no one at home to whom you can say, I'll be back at a specific time, or who you can call to say, or to whom you can just say, voila, I'm home now.
Around 6 p.m., the apartment is warm, clean, well lit, pleasant. I make it that way, energetically, devotedly, enjoying it bitterly. Henceforth and forever, I am my own mother.
Oh. Should I try one more?
You could try one more, and then we'll go into the Pharaoh Sanders track, and then perhaps we could do some more fundraising.
All right, I better just make this. No, that's not very nice.
We'll try and lighten
up. A stupefying, though not distressing, notion that she had not been everything for me. If she had, I wouldn't have written my work. Since I've been taking care of her, the last 6 months, in fact, she was everything for me. And I've completely forgotten that I'd written. I was no longer anything but desperately hers. Before, she had made herself transparent so that I could write.
So now the final piece of music.
Yes, we're ending on a hopeful note.
Oh, really? Yes, end with hope, it says. Part 7, I think. Hope. Love Will Find a Way by Pharaoh Sanders.
Yeah.
And depending on when that finishes, we can then perhaps do a bit more sort of reading of the fundraising.
Okay.
It's a different kind of love for a radio station,
exactly.
Of course.
Give.